today's challenges to the changing family, over concern regarding body, terrorism, lawlessness, anarchy and crime, and economic imbalance in the world economy. My lecture this evening is designed to quiet fear, quicken hope, and bring reassurance to mankind on the subject of over-concern regarding body. It is also designed to fulfill the promise of the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, Mary Baker Eddy, which she gives us in her textbook, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, which she authored and published in 1875. She writes on page 251, "We must learn how mankind govern the body, whether through faith in hygiene, in drugs, or in willpower. We should learn whether they govern the body through a belief in the necessity of sickness, sin and death, sin and pardon, or govern it from the higher understanding that the divine mind God makes perfect acts upon the so-called human mind through truth, leads the human mind to relinquish all error, to find the divine mind to be the only mind and the healer of sin, disease, death. This process of higher spiritual understanding improves mankind until error disappears and nothing is left which deserves to perish or to be punished." To begin my lecture, I would like to share with you the healings which brought not only myself, but my whole family into a lifetime of total reliance on Christian Science and its unique spiritual method of healing. When I was very young, my mother was taken seriously ill. Her father had passed away with tuberculosis shortly prior to her birth. According to the physicians on my mother's case, she too was a victim of that dread disease. X-rays showed that one lung was totally collapsed and the other so heavily infected with scar tissue that the physicians doubted that she could live much longer. Complications of double pneumonia and pleurisy had set in. She was half her normal weight. She suffered intensely, and we had three nurses in the house around the clock. Terror filled my thought at the possible loss of my mother. There was an incredible emptiness. I felt I had no place to turn to still my fear, and I had no conviction that my mother's impending death could be set aside. I had been taught that if God willed it, he would take her unto him. But there was a church across the street from the one I had been attending, and I had noticed that when children came out from it, they were filled with light, joy, and laughter. One Sunday morning, as my father was escorting me to Sunday school, I suddenly hesitated and said, "Please let me visit that church over there." Because my father had no religious convictions at the time, he was perfectly willing to let me go. As I entered the church edifice, the first thing I saw was the inscription on the wall above the rostrum, "God is love." I can't tell you what that meant to me. I had been taught in a Sunday school where the conception of God was that he was an august gentleman stretched out on a heavenly cloud with a record book in his lap in which he was entering every slightest discrepancy that I in any way was involved in. I did not know him as a God of love. I knew him as a God of discipline and a God of punishment. I was taken to a class where the teacher drew me tenderly into the circle of children. And as she looked at me, she must have recognized that I was struggling physically, for she said words to me, biblical words that I can still hear to this day. "The Spirit of God hath made you, and the breath of the Almighty hath given you life." It was a whole new concept to me that my breath of life was a gift from God. I had been under constant medical supervision for asthma. The prediction was that I would not attain adulthood. My arms were punctured from elbow to shoulder in an effort to ascertain the allergies causing it, and my tonsils and adenoids had been removed by surgery in an attempt to free my breathing. From the moment I heard that my breath of life was a gift from God, I never had another attack. I was instantaneously healed of the acute asthma that had been with me since birth. That very afternoon when I reached home, I burst into my mother's room and found our family physician there. He was a stalwart friend, concerned over the challenges my mother and I had been fighting. As he bent to hug me, I blurted out, "I've been to a new church." My father hastened to explain that he had permitted me to visit a Christian Science Sunday school that morning. According to my father's many retellings over the years, the physician turned, walked over to my mother and said, "Mind you, I know nothing firsthand about Christian Science, but I understand it heals through prayer. We've exhausted everything we know in the medical profession on your case. You have a noble husband and a lovely daughter. Don't consent to death. Decide to live. I urge you to try Christian Science." His words were a turning point in our lives. We loved, trusted, and cherished him. He deserved all that Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, implies when she writes in her textbook that great respect is due the motives and philanthropy of the higher class of physicians. My mother had a close friend whom she called immediately and asked, "Do you know anyone who is a Christian Scientist?" There was a pause, and then Mother's friend replied, "My mother is not only a Christian Scientist, she is a Christian Science practitioner, and she's devoting her life to healing others through prayer." Mother's friend then rather apologetically admitted that since her marriage, she had been following a way of life totally different from the standard which had been upheld in her family home. But she assured my mother that she knew her mother would be glad to come and see her. That very afternoon, the Christian Science practitioner came to our home and began sharing the spiritual truths of Christian Science and explaining the healing efficacy of its scientific, spiritual method of prayer. She made very clear to my mother that in order to obtain a healing in Christian Science, one must rely solely on God. My mother immediately gave up all material remedies and drugs which had been prescribed. But how was she to be healed? By the Christian Science practitioner praying daily for her, and by literally pouring in spiritual truths gleaned from the Bible that lifted the whole consciousness of our home, routed the fear, and replaced it with the growing expectancy of good. The way to lift fearful, burdened thought is, as Mrs. Eddy tells us, to pour in truth through flood tides of love. To pour in the truth that God is love, the tender shepherd who watches over, cares for, guides, and protects each and every one of his beloved children. As these spiritual truths were poured into my mother's thought, her healing began. The balance changed from doubt and dismay and from fear and even from consent to death and even the longing for it, to a sense of hope and expectancy and conviction of good. Within 3 months' time, every vestige of the tuberculosis was gone. My mother's flesh was completely regained. She was in radiant health. The three physicians who had been on her case, still fearful and mindful of what their original x-rays had disclosed, urged her, begged her to submit to x-rays once again. She did so, and the x-rays confirmed that both lungs were totally restored to perfect function and healthy organization. She was healed, and everyone openly acknowledged her healing and rejoiced with her. I'd be remiss if I didn't share with you what occurred in the life of the daughter of the practitioner who had been on my mother's case. As she witnessed my mother's daily progress under Christian Science treatment and her full resultant healing, she once again became a totally committed Christian Scientist. And just before I started out on my lecture tour, I called her to share with her the fact that I was including in my lecture an account of the lovely healing which her mother had been instrumental in establishing on behalf of mine. And I found that she has relied on Christian Science for over 50 years and that she's living a happy and useful life in Southern California. These two healings, mine of acute asthma with me since birth, and my mother's healing of tuberculosis complicated by consumption and pneumonia, was indeed the vehicle which brought me and my family into reliance on Christian Science. For these two healings do indeed illustrate the healing efficacy of Christian Science and show how body is indeed governed through spiritual understanding. And now I would like to turn to the six concerns that the Christian Science Board of Directors placed before the Board of Lectureship regarding body. Those six concerns are as follows. First of all, concern regarding food and fear of it. Secondly, worship of bodily exercise. Third, fashion standards causing different concepts regarding body. Fourth, drugs and addiction of alcohol. And fifth, fear of aging, the threat of aging, and also dread of death-dealing disease. Let us turn, first of all, to these over-concerns regarding body, the fears regarding food, weight, exercise, senility, sensuality, death-dealing disease, dependence on drugs, surgery, hygiene, and physiology, all tending to enslave mankind and deprive them of their legitimate, God-given health and radiant well-being. Spiritual understanding gained through the comprehension of the teachings of Christian Science can, will, and does free mankind from bodily limitations and confers perfection, continuity, and immortality made manifest first in health, vitality, vigor, longevity, and radiant well-being. First of all, let us consider preoccupation with food, the love of it, and the inordinate fear of it. Today, the world is caught up in innumerable theories regarding food, regarding diet, health food, polluted foods, and contaminated foods, and in fear of what food can do in adding weight, in fear of lack of right nutrition leading to anorexia, or in fear of the gorging on food leading to bulimia. Following fashionable dietary recommendations, feeling that they can be a quick solution to overindulgence and sensual gluttony, is never the answer to the right demonstration of true control of bodily conditions. Slavish adherence to diet, because of the worship of and striving to attain style and fashion-conscious standards of weight and form, is never the answer to the right demonstration of government and control of body either. Preoccupation with exercise and rigid health procedures is not the answer. Mrs. Eddy asks a pertinent question in Science and Health when she writes, "Is civilization only a higher form of idolatry that man should bow down to a flesh brush, to flannels, to baths, diet, exercise, and air?" She answers her question thusly, "Nothing save divine power is capable of doing so much for man as he can do for himself." End of the quotation. And what must man do? He must feed hunger, but not satiate appetite. He must treat the body with courtesy and punctuality, and it will then utter no complaints or be over-demanding. He must take thought off fear of digestion, of indigestion, of assimilation and elimination, and trust divine mind's regulation and control of body. Diet is never a cure. Rules of health held in thought open the door to digestive troubles, and we need to affirm in our thought only that which we wish to have the body make manifest. Mrs. Eddy tells us of a clergyman who once accepted a severe diet of bread and water in order to increase his spirituality. His health failed, and he gave up his total abstinence and advised others not to try dietetics for growth in grace. The belief that fasting or feasting can make men better, morally or physically, is not tenable in Christian Science. Semi-starvation or gluttony are not acceptable to wisdom. And man is sustained by God, divine mind, for God never ordained a law that fasting should be a means of health. Neither food nor the stomach, without our consent, can make us suffer. And as we acknowledge that the divine mind governs man, we will lose faith in the so-called pleasures and pains of matter. We will literally take less thought about what we eat or drink, and we will consult the stomach less about the economy of our being and of our living. And we will then claim our God-given dominion over dietary, hygienic, and physiological laws concerning food. We will rejoice in the divine fact that man lives because he lives in God, is fed and sustained by God, and maintained in perfect health and well-being. Let us remember Mrs. Eddy's warning. She writes, "Departing from Christian Science, some learners commend diet and hygiene. They even practice these, intending thereby to initiate the cure, which they mean to complete with mind, as if the non-intelligent could aid mind." And she writes further, "Our dietetic theories first admit that food sustains the life of man, and then discuss the certainty that food can kill man. Do you believe that food supports life? Do you believe that food is inimical to your existence? God, divine mind, supports man's life and maintains man's well-being. And Christian Science teaches that Christ's truth gives mortals temporary food and clothing until the material transformed with the ideal disappears and man is clothed and fed spiritually." And Mrs. Eddy asserts further, "I do not maintain that anyone can exist in the flesh without food and raiment, but I do believe that the real man is immortal and that he lives in spirit, not matter." And she says further in Science and Health that in divine science, man is sustained by God, the divine principle of being. The earth, at God's command, brings forth food for man's use. End of the quotation. Then, that God-given food cannot be inimical to man's existence, to his health, or to his beauty. Mrs. Eddy tells us that spirit duly feeds and clothes every object as it appears in the line of spiritual creation, thus tenderly expressing the fatherhood and motherhood of God. The Master, Christ Jesus, commanded his disciples to take no thought for their life, what they should eat or what they should drink or what they should put on the body. And he recognized God, the Father and the Mother of all, as able to feed and clothe man as he doth the lilies. Mrs. Eddy tells us that Jesus never taught that drugs, food, air, and exercise could make a man healthy, or that they could destroy human life. Nor did he illustrate these errors by his practice. But the Master did tenderly and compassionately care for human needs. He fed the multitudes. He did not send them away to go into the villages to buy themselves victuals. No, he said to his disciples, "They need not depart. Give ye them to eat." According to the account in the Gospel of Matthew, in the King James Version of the Bible, the disciples had only 5 loaves and 2 fishes, inadequate, according to their thought, to feed the multitude. But what did the master do? He took what they had at hand, looked up unto heaven, blessed and brake it, and gave it back to his disciples to distribute. He well knew that his disciples needed to learn the lesson of God's sufficiency to feed his children. They did distribute, and the record tells us that they did all eat and were filled, and they had 12 baskets full of fragments remaining. 5,000 men beside women and children were fed that day. The master always tenderly cared for human needs. He fed the hungry, and he healed the hearts of all who came to him for comfort and for solace. The spiritual fact is that food does not affect the absolute life of man, for God is our life. But at the point of our present understanding, it is foolish to stop eating until we gain a clear understanding that we do not eat to live or live to eat. As we grow in the spiritual understanding that divine mind governs and controls body, we will find that the harmonious functions of the body cannot be endangered by food. And dietetic theory will lose its hold on our thoughts. We shall eat without fear and rejoice in love's tender provision for our care and our sustenance. The next concern that I'd like to discuss with you is that of exercise. And just as strict fasting and gluttonous eating cannot be the basis for the proper control of body, even so the overstimulus of exercise cannot impair man's well-being. Today there is an almost euphoric stimulus derived from certain aspects of material exercise, such as jogging. And I'm reminded of an experience of a Christian Science teacher who was accosted by an individual who was critical of the fact that the teacher had a lovely mare, which he rode every afternoon after he left his practitioner's office. And, accosting him, she said, "Do you ride horseback for your health?" His reply was, "No, madam, I ride horseback because I am healthy." Mrs. Eddy tells us in Science and Health that mind, joyous in strength, dwells in the realm of mind, and that mind's infinite ideas run and disport themselves. So let us run and disport ourselves, joyous in our God-given strength, vitality, and vigor. Let us, as Mrs. Eddy counsels, exercise our God-given authority, and let us take possession of our body and govern its feeling and action. Let us rejoice that God has made us capable of this, and let us feel the divine energies of spirit bringing us into newness of life and recognizing no mortal or material power as able to destroy. Let us rejoice that we are subject to the divine powers that be, and let us remind ourselves, too, that that body which is left most out of our thought is going to be the healthiest body. The next topic covers the fashion world and its influence on concepts of body. The fashion world has done everything it can to intensify the presentation of women as sensual, sexual objects, bringing undue emphasis on sexuality and sensuality, tending to demean women by near nudity, blatant exposure, sensually stimulating emphasis on body, robbing womanhood of dignity, refinement, and modesty. Under the direction of the standard of Christian Science, the human body is always handled with modesty, dignity, and refinement. Overexposure, nudity, blatant sensuality degrade mankind, both men and women. And Mrs. Eddy has said that immortal men and women are models of spiritual sense, drawn by perfect mind and reflecting those higher conceptions of loveliness which transcend all material sense. End of the quotation. Beauty, grace, loveliness of form, outlined in color, These charms of being are man's divine right to express, and modesty in the handling of the human body bespeaks spirituality. Immodesty in the handling of the human body bespeaks sensuality. Mrs. Eddy urges us to turn from matter models with their deformity and with their perversion, and urges us to form perfect models in thought, to look at them continually, and to carve them out in grand and noble lives. End of the quotation. Then we will indeed have before us models of excellence and loveliness. Let us rejoice that man is not a sensual, sexual object. Man is not the source of selfish gratification for another, nor is he an incomplete idea. Man reflects the fullness of the fatherhood and motherhood of God. He has no unsatisfied longings, no unfulfilled hopes, no pressing imperative demands of the flesh. For man is complete, satisfied, and divinely fair. The next subject is the control of appetites and moods through the use of drugs and alcohol, which have proven to be tragically disastrous and death-inducing. Many young people today are indulging in drugs and in alcohol, and the combination can prove to be acutely death-dealing. It is a lust for thrill and for excitement, and our chemically oriented society is believing in the thrill and excitement of drugs, in the stimulus of alcohol, and of the control of the emotions and appetites through the use of both of these. Many of the theories regarding the treatment of insanity today are based on the belief of chemical imbalances in the system, and there is much experimentation going on the subject of chemical changes in the body in order to bring a change to the mental capacities and to control the brain. Any seeking of chemical control of man's emotions, his brain or his body, will destroy true self-control. Let us remember that all true control is vested in divine mind, God, and not in matter. And now we turn to the fear of aging. Fear of aging is very prevalent in human thought. It is part of the pattern of the cycle from birth to death that the whole world so generally believes in. From the time that a child appears, the question is always, how old is he? Never, how new is he? The inception of human birth brings with it immediately the whole pattern of growth, development, aging, and ultimate death. The whole concept of from cradle to the grave underlies the fear of aging and of dying, and under this concept, our early years are marked by the gaining of capacities and capabilities, reaching a point which at its best is always nebulous, the so-called point of perfection, and an immediate decline and slide from the apex of that uncertain perfection into disease, dissolution, aging, senility, decay, and death. What is the truth of this? The glorious facts are these. Man is spiritual. Mankind need not fear that disease can bring decay, dissolution, and death, for God's man cannot be the victim of disease, dissolution, decay, and death. Man, in science, does not grow old. Man is forever the expression of the vitality of life, of the indestructibility of spirit, of the strength of truth, of the radiance of love, of the intelligence of mind, of the satisfaction of soul, of the might of divine principle, all reflecting the various facets of God's complete nature. Man does not undergo birth, maturity, and decay. Man does not flicker out in death, nor does he spring from matter into life. Man in science is neither young nor old. He is eternal and infinite. He does not have birth and death, beginning and ending. He has continuity and immortality. And he does not pass from matter to mind, from the mortal to the immortal, from evil to good, or from good to evil. Mrs. Eddy tells us in Science and Health that infancy, helplessness, and decadence do not belong to man. What does belong to man? Everlasting grandeur and immortality of development, power, and prestige. Man is ageless. Man is infinite. Man's faculties are not limited by the belief of age. They are forever maintained in perfect capacity and usefulness, for they are spiritual, not material faculties. They are spiritual senses, not material senses. Let us stop measuring our life and its potential by chronological data, and let us be obedient to Mrs. Eddy's instruction, never record ages. We can prove to an ever-increasing degree that man has illimitable reservoirs of vigor, ever-renewing freshness and promise. Immortal men and women are models of spiritual sense, models of infinite loveliness, beauty, and grace. Loveliness of form and color and outline are inherent in man's true being, and fear cannot burden man with the ugliness of excessive weight. We cannot have weakness or deformity of structure, for man's structure is perfectly aligned, perfect in conformity, and altogether lovely. Man is the radiant expression of immortal mind, the perfect model of God's conceiving. Man, we, you and I, are ever moving forward, sustained by the divine energy of spirit into newness of life, immortality, continuity, and radiant well-being. And now, to deal with the subject of the dread of death-dealing disease, I should like to share with you how the threat of death-dealing disease was completely met as I grew in the spiritual understanding of divine mind's control of body. Many years ago, my body developed a large and unsightly disfiguring tumor. I had to adopt my clothing to compensate for it, and I became sick and fearful at heart over the condition. One afternoon, as I was driving into town, I passed the largest outdoor advertising billboard in the city. It was solid black, except for a bright red crab down in the lower left-hand corner. By the time I'd driven two or three blocks further on, my hands were wet and cold with fear. My knees had turned to water and my feet were shaking. I had recognized the insignia of the bright red crab as that of the Cancer Fund crusade, and it brought terror to my heart. Of course it was the fear of cancer that had lain back in my thoughts. I had diagnosed my case in terms of malignancy and possible impending death. When I reached home, I turned to my Bible, a copy of the King James Version, for comfort, and I studied carefully every one of Jesus' healings in the New Testament. As I did so, I caught a glimpse of his healing method, and my fear began to lessen. I also studied carefully in the Christian Science textbook, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, what Mrs. Eddy had to say regarding Jesus' healing method. Among the many illuminating statements that I found were these: Jesus never spoke of disease as dangerous or as difficult to heal. He never described disease, so far as can be learned from the Gospels, but he healed disease. He prescribed no drugs, urged no obedience to material laws, but acted in direct disobedience to them. Jesus never asked if disease were acute or chronic, and he never recommended attention to laws of health, never gave drugs, never prayed to know if God were willing that a man should live. Then what did the Master do? The Bible shows us that he prayed. He denied the inevitability of death, and he saw it as an enemy to be overcome. He knew that God was the very life of man, that God was the only creator of man, and that God made man perfect and immortal in his image and likeness. Sin, sickness, and death never intimidated the master. Death neither impressed him nor depressed him. And he knew that man's perfection, continuity, and immortality were derived from God, omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient, divine love. And since God is the source of man's being, man can never be in jeopardy or in danger. For divine mind, God holds his beloved child forever safe. The healing that meant the most to me of the master's was that of Jairus' daughter, as recorded in Luke. You will remember that Jairus was the ruler of the synagogue's house, and that he had a lovely child who was perilously close to death. He had gone to enlist the master's support on behalf of his child, but before he reached him, his servant caught up with him and said to him, "Trouble not the master. Thy daughter is dead." Jesus overheard this pronouncement, and turning to Jairus, he said, "Fear not, believe only, and she shall be made whole." And then he took Jairus, the mother of the maiden, and three of his most trusted disciples, Peter, James, and John, with him, and went to Jairus' house and entered the chamber of the maiden. At what they saw, the account says, they all wept and bewailed her. But the master said, "Weep not. She is not dead, but sleepeth." And the account says they all laughed him to scorn, knowing that she was dead. And what did the master do? He put them all out. And turning to the maiden, he said, "Maid, arise." And her spirit came again unto her, and she arose straightway, and he commanded to give her meat. I determined on the basis of that healing that I would never again look at the condition. I would not feel it. I would not probe it, but I would turn totally from it, and I would not attempt to see what new forms it was assuming. I promised myself that every time I was tempted to examine it, I would pick up Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures or the Bible, and I would read out loud from them until I had put down and out the mesmeric temptation to examine matter. I realized that I had to put all out of my consciousness everything that wept over the condition, everything that bewailed the challenge I was facing, and anything in me that laughed to scorn the healing efficacy of the Christ truth. I remember one day pacing up and down the living room of our small apartment, reading out loud from those two blessed textbooks for 4.5 hours. So pressing was the mesmeric temptation to examine matter, which I knew would only make me more fearful of it. I won that hour of challenge. And the next day, I found a statement in another one of Mrs. Eddy's volumes entitled Unity of Good in her prose works. The statement that I found is on page 60, lines 27 through 28. And this did indeed begin to break the mesmeric fear in which I had been held. The statement is this: "This false sense of substance must yield to his eternal presence and so dissolve." I saw that the only legitimate diagnosis for this growth was a false sense of substance. That's all it was. And there was a spiritual demand that had been placed upon this false sense of substance. Mrs. Eddy said it must yield to his, to God's eternal presence. And she even told me how it would go. She said, "Dissolve." I began to use that statement like a two-edged sword. And every time that my thought was drawn to that growth, I declared, "You are only a false sense of substance. You must yield to his, to God's eternal presence, and you must dissolve." I then found a passage on page 242 of the Christian Science textbook where Mrs. Eddy tells us in part that divine love is the universal solvent that dissolves the adamant of error. I was led to look up in Webster's Unabridged Dictionary the definition of the word adamant, and I found that its primary definition is an imaginary stone of impenetrable hardness. And I said to myself, how can that which is imaginary be impenetrably hard? That which is imaginary is only a figment of the imagination. And God, divine love, does indeed dissolve any stubborn, unyielding condition of matter. I took Mrs. Eddy's statement, and I lived with it. And every time my thought was mesmerically drawn to the physical condition, I prayerfully affirmed it was only a false sense of substance, that it must yield to God's presence and that it must dissolve. And I found a further statement on page 412 of the textbook, in that section of the chapter known as Christian Science Practice, where Mrs. Eddy explains mental treatment illustrated. And she gives us an imperative command. She says, realize the presence of health and the fact of harmonious being until the body corresponds with the normal conditions of health and harmony. And I asked myself, how long must I persist in realizing the presence of health and the fact of harmonious being? And I found the answer right within the sentence. Until the body corresponds with the normal conditions of health and harmony. I knew I must persist, and I did. And some time later, I suddenly realized that my clothing was hanging loosely. The tumor had dissolved. There was no longer a need to compensate for the growth. My skin was fresh and healthy, and every trace of the condition had dissolved before the presence and the power of omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient divine love. The body had corresponded to the normal conditions of health and harmony, and I was free. That healing was established over 40 years ago, and I've never seen a trace or a vestige of that tumor since that time. I have seen Christian Science dissolve other tumors. And Webster defines a tumor in four parts. First, an abnormal mass of tissue. Second, arising without obvious cause. Third, possessing no physiological function. And fourth, unrestrained in growth and structure. On the basis of that definition, you and I can rationally reason that that which is abnormal is illegitimate, that that which arises without cause can have no effect, that that which possesses no function is extraneous, useless, and unnecessary. And that which is unrestrained in growth has no root and no foundation. The secretion and accretion of matter is never true growth. True growth can never be unrestrained, disobedient, or rebellious. And true growth can include only normal, orderly development. True growth is regulated by the law of God, by the law of divine mind, the only regulator of man's true being. The law of divine mind regulates and controls man's body, maintaining it in perfect order, abundant health and well-being. And man can never be the victim of death-dealing malignant disease, for the only true growth is the growth in the understanding that body is governed by spiritual understanding, by divine mind. The only regulator of man's true being. The law of divine mind regulates and controls man's body, maintaining it in perfect order, abundant health and well-being. And man can never be the victim of death-dealing malignant disease, for the only true growth is the growth in the understanding that body is governed by spiritual understanding, by divine mind. In Matthew, we read a brief parable which the Master gave us. The kingdom of heaven is like unto leaven, which a woman took and hid in 3 measures of meal till the whole was leavened. That parable always reminds me of Mary Baker Eddy. And we can indeed reason that the 3 measures of meal are likened unto science, theology, and medicine. And her teachings on the subject of body have permeated all 3 of these facets of human thought. She made deep, thorough-based systems were thoroughly wanting only through the revelation of the teachings of the Bible and the Master's teachings did she find the key to true healing and the freeing of body from sin, disease, and death. She turned from all that material matter physicians taught, and as a spiritual metaphysician, a divine mind physician, she gave to mankind her revolutionary teachings on divine mind's control of body. In Reverend Irving C. Tomlinson's book entitled 12 Years with Mary Baker Eddy, we find an account of one of the thousands of healings that Mary Baker Eddy established in her years of the practice of the healing ministry of Christian Science. The healing that I'd like to share with you tonight is the healing of a Mr. John Scott of East Stoughton, Massachusetts. According to the physicians, he had enteritis. He'd had complete stoppage of the bowels for 2 weeks, and the 2 physicians who were in attendance upon his case had informed his wife that her husband was close to death. At this point, she called Mrs. Eddy and asked her if she would please come to their home and see her husband. Mrs. Eddy did indeed do this. As she entered the home, she found Mr. Scott vomiting violently, rolling on the floor, shrieking in agony, and cursing God. She said to him, "If you will be calm, I can heal you." And he immediately quieted down. In less than an hour, his pain was entirely gone. The vomiting had stopped. The bowel action had resumed normalcy. And before Mrs. Eddy left, he declared that he felt perfectly well. The next day, he attended to his business, and in the late afternoon, he attended to his farm chores. But this was not the limitation of what that treatment did for him. It was a remarkable healing, because more remarkable because of the transference in his thought and in his life than in just his physical restoration. His wife wrote Mrs. Eddy that prior to this healing, he had never fondled his children, but on the night of his recovery, he had called each child to him and embraced them, told them that he loved them, and assured his wife that I'm going to be a better man. She wrote further to Mrs. Eddy, "Thank you for restoring my husband to health. But more than all, I am grateful for what you have done for him morally and spiritually." This healing of Mrs. Eddy's is one among many, is indeed indicative of the healing in Christian Science, which not only restores man physically, but strengthens man morally and uplifts man spiritually. It was the coincidence of the divine and the human in our Master's healing mission which enabled him to bring the truth to human consciousness, establishing healing and freedom for all mankind and overcoming sin, disease, and death. It was Christ Jesus' full awareness of God, divine mind's control of body, his recognition of the immortality of man's true being, of man's perfection as the reflection and the image and likeness of God, that enabled him to always behold the perfect man. The perfect man where sinning, sick, dying humanity appears to mortals. And his glorious healing brought a complete refutation to the lie that life is dependent on bodily conditions. And this enabled him to heal the sick and the sinning, and to raise the dying and the dead to life. Mrs. Eddy, in referring to Jesus' raising of Lazarus from the tomb, from death, asked the question, Who dares doubt this consummate test of the power and willingness of divine mind to hold man forever intact in his perfect state and to govern man's entire action? This question she sets before us, she has already answered. Consummate spiritual metaphysician that she is, she has shown us through the revelation of Christian Science and the setting forth of the Christly healing rules that over-concern for body can yield wholly and completely to divine mind's absolute, incontestable control of body, which maintains man's true body forever in perfection, continuity, indestructible identity, and immortality. The teachings of Christian Science make clear, and these statements are based on Mrs. Eddy's statement, "What is Man?" in the chapter Recapitulation, page 475 of the Christian Science textbook. She says, "Man is not matter. Man is not constituted of brain, flesh, blood, bones, tendons, muscles, organs. Man is spiritual," she says, "made in the image and likeness of God. Man is perfect," she says. "He is not a physiological, anatomical structure governed by laws of health and hygiene. Man is the compound idea of God," she says, "including all right ideas. And divine mind maintains man's true sense of identity, his true sense of body. For man's true identity, man's true sense of body, is the reflection of all of God's laws and their intelligent and harmonious action, which bestow on man abundant health, perfect order and function, manifest in indestructible and eternal being and immortal life." To conclude, let me return to Mrs. Eddy's opening statement. "For divine mind makes perfect, acts upon the human mind through truth, leads the human mind to relinquish all error, to find the divine mind to be the only mind and the healer of sin, disease, and death. This process of higher spiritual understanding improves mankind until error disappears, and nothing is left which deserves to perish or be punished. For body is governed harmoniously through spiritual understanding." I should like to leave with you a benediction from Mary Baker Eddy. "May the grace and love of God be and abide with you all. Thank you for coming, and good evening."